Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Maura Berman, who is a music teacher and an artist. We met just recently, and I was so intrigued, but always am, by the entire concept of music, what it is, what it does, and teaching it. So I asked Maura to do this with me, and we were talking about, I like to start as back as far as I can go, to what leads up to today. So and it was pretty interesting, so I'm just going to ask you, Maura, to start wherever you want, and you do it.
Okay, thank you, Janet. We'll do it from the beginning of my music career. A best friend of mine had a piano, and I was jealous of her having a piano and
How
piano
old were you?
Lessons. Seven and a half. So my mother bought me a piano, and she did research on finding a teacher, and we lived in Long Island, which was the suburbs of New York City, mm-hmm. and she phoned the Juilliard School and found a teacher in our vicinity, and so my first piano lesson was with a teacher from Juilliard, and she was very loving, very instructive, and I learned quite a bit. And then when I was in 10th grade, she...
Wait, but so you stayed with this piano teacher?
Yes, yes. And then when I was in 10th grade, she said, I can't teach you anymore. You need to go higher. So I applied to the Juilliard Music School Preparatory Division. So it was for grade school, high schoolers. Every Saturday would be your main instrument and then a theory class, music theory class. So I got in on an honorary scholarship, and it's a tough school to get into because you had to audition twice to stay in it during the year. You had exams. So I studied with Jane Carlson there, who was a great teacher, very strict, but I learned quite a bit. And
were you intimidated by her strictness, or you appreciated it?
No,
or
both. I appreciate it. She was a very big woman, and unfortunately, I had her before lunch. So,
stomach at knots.
Yes.
You mean, yeah.
But you know, I did really well there, and decided that I'd like to continue with piano. And so, throughout my high school years, because I would go to Juilliard on Saturday, it would be spent. The Juilliard Music School in New York at that time was in Harlem, 125th Street and West Side Avenue, and now I think it's housed by Manhattan School of Music. So the whole day of Saturday was Juilliard. Mm-hmm. And in order to, you know, to stay in Juilliard, and really what I wanted to do was either be a pianist professionally or teach piano. I knew that from an early age in high school.
So you have a feel for teaching, because not everybody can. That's a separate art.
Well, let's
put separate talent.
Yes, it is. But at the time when I was thinking of that, it was like a fallback if I didn't make it as a pianist, which...
Okay.
You know, I thought, oh, it's so easy to you know, perform and have a concert career. Little did I know. But so that meant in high school, I had no social life. I didn't go to the prom. I didn't go to any school dances. My mother, very strict, saw that I did 4 hours a day.
Oh, so I was going to ask you about your mother, because it sounds like she, you talked about her being difficult, but it sounds like she was very much on your side, whipping into action to get you from a teacher from Juilliard when you said at seven you wanted lessons.
That is true. She was on my side. That's one of the few times. No.
Okay, but she gets credit for that one,
yeah,
right?
She gets credit for that one.
Okay.
Yes. And I thank her for that. And so doing a lot of practicing, and then when it came time for college, I applied and got into Oberlin Conservatory. Early admission, so that was pretty much it in my senior year. And when I went to Oberlin, I studied there with Emil Dannenberg, who became dean of the music school, then president of the college, until he fortunately passed away. And while I was at Oberlin, I started teaching. I had some students.
Did that come naturally to you?
Yeah. Okay.
At your own teachers and know what you wanted to do more of.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, what Oberlin was an eye-opener because I thought, oh, I'm so gifted and blah, blah, blah. And then I go to Oberlin and everyone
is gifted.
So, okay, cross out the concert career. Let's do the fallback, which was piano teaching.
And where was your mother during all this?
Well, luckily, Oberlin and New York were not in the same town.
No.
Did
she come visit you, or did you go home? Or
I went home.
How did life go with her?
I went home for breaks, but didn't really see much of my family because I was, you know, at school most of the time. And then met my first husband, who was a composer. I met him as a piano major at Oberlin, got married right after college, and applied for graduate school, and it was me who got us into University of Michigan with a piano teaching assistantship. So that was really my first real experience teaching, but it was class piano, which I kind of liked. I enjoyed it, and it was for students who needed piano proficiency to graduate, so they would be, you know, wind majors, voice majors.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be six upright pianos in the room, sometimes two to a piano. And I would walk around and give instructions. So my eyes had to look at everyone's mm-hmm. hand position because there were
12 hands.
Yeah.
That's right.
In the classroom. And I can say I had an amazing piano pedagogy teacher, Alice M. Kern, who headed the piano pedagogy department, and I learned so much from her.
Is she still alive?
No. But she took us, the class, piano pedagogy class, to, I think it was Michigan State or Ypsilanti College, to look at their class piano department to compare it to University of Michigan. It was all electronic pianos. They did have one teacher, but he just sat and with earphones could hear. But there would be people reading newspapers, and she would go, after we, you know, observed this class and went back to U of M, she goes, this is what you never want to get into, electronic pianos.
Okay.
You want uprights, and you want physical touching, seeing.
So she knew to teach by negative example.
Yes.
A lot of that's good in life.
Yes, and she also wrote a book on all the piano books there are with publishers, all the music from A to Z, Baroque to contemporary, and put them in different, like, elementary, beginners mm-hmm. elementary. So that was a really good guide, too, that helped me.
I can just picture first piano books and first music books.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, I remember in my own lessons, and I do this in general with math classes or language or music,
yes.
I mean, in particular, you have some very simple first page. And then I always look at the very last page and think, I'm never going to be able to do this. I am never going to be able to speak French. I am never going to understand calculus, you know, to go to the last page.
Right.
And yet we do.
Yes.
And taking students from that, well, what you call proficiency, is really a miracle work.
Yes, and
although some people are natural.
Yes, and I have to say there are a lot of, I hate saying the word, using the word bad, but mm-hmm. piano teachers that should not be piano teachers.
Oh, I had one of them as a kid. Oh, he was brutal. Yeah.
Either they just figured, oh, I can play the piano, never had any piano teaching or instruction for piano pedagogy at all.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because there is the concept in too much of life, I think, that if you can do something well, you can teach it. If you know physics well, you can teach it. If you are a wonderful pianist, not true. There
not
are different
true.
Talents.
Yes.
So what does it take to get somebody to want to stay with it and to practice and get better? Yes.
That's a tough question, but
You have to do that to be a good teacher.
Yes. First of all, I have so much patience.
Oh,
you have
good.
To have patience. And I also have really good syllabus in my piano teaching.
That you've written yourself?
No, that I from my teacher at University of Michigan. And I realize how important music theory is, because a lot of music teachers, piano teachers in particular, don't teach music theory. They just teach what's written on the page, and that's not the full meaning of learning music.
Okay, so that's what I want to get to. What is the full meaning of learning music? Because I see it as such just a foreign language that you can barely talk about in English or any spoken language.
Correct. And I tell that to the beginning, the little kids that I have, and I'm kind of focusing on intermediate and advanced students from now on, but I had 4 or 5-year-olds, started them up until 99, but would tell them that you are very fortunate you were learning a foreign language.
Oh, good. Then I'm so glad you said that, because that's what it is.
And you show this to someone in your class, you show this piece of music, and they wouldn't know what that is.
Okay, so we're exactly on the same page.
Yes, but you were learning this, and it's a beautiful language, because it gives so much joy to your ears and your heart.
Do you ever listen to a piece of music and know the story that's being told?
Yes, and well, I have perfect pitch.
Oh.
So that's a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah.
The good thing is when I listen to music, I know what key it's in. I know the notes. So I not only hear the music, I can visually see it.
Is that burdensome?
No, unless you're listening to a recording that is out of tune and you're following the score and it's, wait a second, you know.
But it's not burdensome for you.
No, not at all. But what's interesting about having perfect pitch, and my husband plays this game with me all the time. We're in the car and we listen to Sirius XM or FM, whatever the, and he'll cover it up and he'll say, okay, who's the composer? So it's like guessing the composer. And I definitely know the period that it was written in, and most of the time I could guess the composer. And he said, you should be on a game show. There should be a game show. But I also, it really helps to go to very good music schools. If anyone's listening that has a child or themselves interested in learning music, go to the best schools, because the teacher at Oberlin College played Drop the Needle. And
on a record.
Okay, so that tells you my age.
Right. Never mind that thing.
Right. And he would
I remember doing that as a kid.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. So he would drop it, and we'd have to say what period it was and the composer. So.
And when you say drop, you really mean put.
Right.
Who are of that age, we don't want to,
No, we don't want to scratch the record. So gently put the needle down. So. So getting back to perfect pitch, I would listen to music, and a lot of the times, and it's with this all in the arts, composers, artists borrow from other artists that they relate to, that inspire them. So I'll be listening to a piece of music, and I hear a section, and I'll like cover my ears thinking,
you know that from someone else?
I know that. Okay, which composer was alive first that took that? But it will be the same exact pitch and the same melody. So that's annoying, because if I can't think of it...
Yeah. I that's kind of in those areas I meant. But that's true in painting and writing and everything.
Yes,
in
painting.
People borrow unintentionally, because something settles into your soul, and then it's yours.
And that happens in my art, too, sometimes when I was doing art, I would just kind of do an image and think, oh my God, that's like this artist that I have been looking at artist books. Because that's what I do before I paint. I need to get inspired. So I look at various art books. It can be art of a different period that's different from mine or the same, just to kind of inspire me, and because I have a blank canvas in front of me. And I have to put something on it.
Yes. And it takes a very mature person to see a blank piece of paper or a blank canvas as your friend.
Yes.
It's a little bit intimidating.
Yes. And I've also composed a few pieces as well, some choir pieces and a piano sonata.
Oh.
that I did later on in life, just before I moved here.
Well, talk about in between then and here, if you want to.
Yes.
So you went back to New York at some point?
No.
Oh, you were in San Diego. Okay, you...
So I graduated Oberlin, got married, went to the University of Michigan. So I lived in the Midwest, and my husband at the time was a composer and got his doctorate at University of Michigan. And then we went to Canada.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Because he, and it still does, teach at the University of British Columbia in composition and theory, music theory. So we were there, and I had my two children. Well, one was in Germany.
And well, you have been around.
Yes, Germany, between Ann Arbor and University of British Columbia, he got a Fulbright scholarship to study with Karlheinz Stockhausen in Cologne. So I was there pregnant and in Germany in a foreign country and didn't know German. But actually, I did teach. I had one piano student in Germany. So that was my life there. But when we were at University of British Columbia, I did a lot of accompanying. And then after that, I got divorced from him, met my second husband, who was American, mm-hmm. a lawyer, and we didn't like living in Vancouver. It was British Reserve, and it was different from the U.S. at the time, and this was in the mm-hmm. 70s, 80s. And we moved down to San Diego.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's what brought me to San Diego.
So you never went back to New York.
No.
So bye-bye, Mama.
Although, no, not by, because my parents, growing up, my father would say, okay, we're moving to California, and I had visions when I was still living in New York of cute blonde surfer boys.
Yeah.
Surfer boys, and when are we moving? We're telling all our friends, we're moving to California. Well, that never happened. I went to college.
Oh, you said that when you were young.
Yes, in high school, and I just thought that would be so great to move to beach and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But they did move when I was in college. So they moved to Los Angeles and then San Diego.
Oh, I see. So they were nearby then still.
Yes. So when my second husband and I moved to San Diego, they were in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So it was close by.
Okay.
And, it was 6-7 hours by car, so we wouldn't see them that often, but it was more often than my living in mm-hmm. Vancouver, Canada, or at college.
So she seemed to be kind of dependent on you for some kind of satisfaction. And yet she did okay when you were in Canada and Germany. And
correct.
Okay.
yeah, she did. I had a brother and a father, and they both had passed away. So it was my mother living by herself. And I was in San Diego in a marriage with two additional children, so I have two boys from
mm-hmm.
him,
mm-hmm.
and I was probably doing more art than music,
mm-hmm.
because I found in San Diego, for some reason, in the suburbs, not the downtown San Diego, it was difficult getting piano students.
Interesting.
And I don't know why, but it just was, so I immersed myself in my art.
Now you're in San Francisco and you're teaching music again.
Yes.
What
yes.
do you teach?
I teach in Coal Valley at our house.
Oh, I see. And you're not at Cap Street or something.
No, mm-hmm. no. Although I did go there first, Community Music Center.
Mm-hmm.
And being that I was a little bit more qualified than the salary that mm-hmm. I could charge there, because it was more a community thing and for affordable lessons.
When you sound more qualified, you sound just huge, if I may say.
Oh, yeah. I for my what I've been charging and...
I mean, your ability and your...
Yes, yes.
Your and whole
right.
core and soul there.
Right. And I must say, I was always my boss. So, and always teaching privately, which I liked. I can set my own hours, and I have my own piano.
What do you want children to get? And I'm assuming you're teaching children. Maybe you have adults.
No, both, adults and children.
What do you want them to get?
I want them to love music. I want them to be able to sit down at the piano and play something that they like. to play.
So you're,
just
you're
enjoy music.
For the joy.
Yes.
Oh, that's so
I don't
nice.
Expect them to be concert pianists.
Sure.
Because it's not an easy road, as I realized.
So when we met, I remember saying to you, after I learned you were a music teacher, there was a bumper sticker I saw years ago that so touched me that I can still visualize it. And it had, you know, a staff with maybe 6-8 notes
yes.
on it. And it said, if you can read this, thank a piano teacher.
I have that bumper sticker. Because I saw it too, yes.
Piano teachers, or music, well, all teachers really, mm-hmm. release something in us. Important. But especially in the abstract, mm-hmm. not to take away anything from social studies teachers.
No.
Or anything.
No.
But there's something about communicating in the abstract
and
that is so
right.
empowering.
And I think also that, and it's been studied, that music does help with school. And especially in math, because music is all math.
Well, I remember my daughter saying this because she's both. And she, at one point, responded to something by saying, oh, doesn't he know that if math could talk, it would be music?
Exactly.
And, of course, they're exactly related.
Yes. Well, I have a specific theory book, music theory book, that I use. And it's really interesting in this book by Sandy Feldstein. She, not in the very, very beginning because you're learning the notes, but when mm-hmm. she gets into counting and rhythm, she actually has math, music math. So she'll have a quarter note plus a half note equals. So you're adding notes and you're subtracting notes. So it's all music. And then when it gets into eighth notes, you have half
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
counting, which means fractions.
Yes.
So students, my piano students, are learning fractions before they learn it in school.
Yes.
Just for music. So
well, and also people who are attracted to it. You know, as you may have noticed that very often in high school, the music teacher and the math teacher are one and the same.
Oh, actually? Really?
It was very common when I was going to school. The music teacher was always the math teacher.
Interesting. I guess I never...
Maybe it wasn't true where you grew
no.
up, but...
But that's interesting. I could see how that would work.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. I remember that distinctly.
But, you know, like what I want the kids or adults or people to get out of music with, especially hard times, as we all know we're facing, music to me is medicine for the soul and art, visual art,
sure.
music. But it just, when people are sad... When people are happy, they listen to music.
And, of course, rhythm is essential.
Yes.
I mean, we are such rhythm-driven creatures. Rhythm drives our entire life.
Okay. So, and tell
I'm
me
just
what...
Just mentioning. Well, I mean, that's kind of built into music
mm-hmm.
in a very perceptible way.
Right.
That satisfies something, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
Because I ask this, and because it is kind of my focus.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to write a love letter right now, who would it be to?
Oh, boy.
Do you ever write letters?
I used to.
When did you used to?
Before the computer age.
Okay, sure.
And you know what? Don't get me started on letters. Because
I'd love to get you started on letters.
I have writing from my father and my brother that I look at periodically because... They're now not with me, but when you look at handwriting,
you
could see them in the handwriting.
Yes.
You know, you could see them. It's their own personality.
So I can retire and just let you do this now.
because on the computer,
everybody
too.
Has Lucida Bright. Nobody has your handwriting.
Correct. You read, you write emails. It's... You know, okay, so the words are the person, you know, but
the handwriting is the hard
correct.
I have a
correct.
Question then, or
yes.
kind of a comment that goes with this. Yes, so handwriting is king.
Yes, definitely.
And when my mother died, my niece, who lived, near her, everybody was bereft and sad, and it was just a force in this world gone. And it doesn't matter... how much you expected death, that last breath is just
right.
something indescribable.
Yes.
And so every time my niece would find a letter, something in my mother's handwriting, she would call me and say, I found a card from Grandma. It's her handwriting. I can see her. And I got for probably 6 months these calls that she found another something
from
Grandma in her handwriting. So you are so right. And you're also reading something that's felt the touch of that person's hand.
Yes.
So what about writing to your children? And so they have something in your handwriting.
You know I did that with my two boys at home, and hopefully they have some. I know I have some of their handwriting when they were little kids, and I think they have some of mine.
Oh, good. Okay. Because it does that magic.
Yes.
When we're not here, that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it really does. And for this generation and future generations that do not do hand, that do not write, it's sad.
Oh, it's also interfering with crime detection, but that's a whole other story. It is. With the disappearance of cursive writing, it's a whole other problem. Love and crime, two things that are suffering.
I mean, children didn't know. We went to school and we had to have good penmanship.
Right.
We got grades in penmanship. As a matter of fact, my penmanship was so good that I didn't have to take any more exams. My sixth grade teacher.
But you know, when you see a sheet of music, when you see something written, I mean, you look at a piece of the music itself.
Yes.
You read a score, not something printed by a machine, but you see
notes. When you said that, I was thinking in some of the editions of music, they have Beethoven's score from that piano sonata in the front of the book, and it's amazing. Yes. Amazing to look at, and then you think.
It's also amazing that anyone could read it.
I think we're reading each other's mind, because I'm thinking, how could anyone decipher this?
Right.
Or no.
Let alone a half note from a quarter
note. I don't know how they did it. I don't know.
Okay, so I'm so glad you're on the handwriting because it is astounding. Well, I hope you do. I hope periodically. And also, you know, we are all part of some history. But you've had experience that no one else has had in a field that has historical importance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe to me, anyway. But I think it does. And people will find letters from you, never mind just your children and grandchildren. They'll find it in 100 years.
Right.
And know something
that
happened. Well, somebody probably will. Oh, if you use ink and good paper.
Yes, that's right.
It's so worth laying a little trail of yourself.
It is.
You have something to say like you do.
Yes.
Okay, and then there's also one to your mother for getting you into Juilliard.
Yes, that's true. And for actually to my mother for finding my first piano teacher. Because I would write a love letter to her because she got me, she moved me along and said, I can't teach you anymore. I think you need some other further instruction. And I appreciate that.
So I like those as part, you know, whenever we find letters, actual letters from people, that's the real history.
Yes.
And I mean, Juilliard would probably love to put that in their archives.
Yes. And you know,
you could write it and say, dear whoever, you're writing to your children or to yourself or to the people at Juilliard now. And say, dear, your teacher's name.
Right.
I'm writing this to you, but I'm sending it to, you know, the dean of Juilliard now, because I don't know where else to send it. But
well, you know, and I keep music from when I had lessons with her. I have the music. It might be torn and scotch taped, but I see her handwriting, like, play this softer. And when I see that, I see her.
Okay. So you've got to, I mean, that would be great, I think, if you took the time to do a couple of these.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to cry now at your saying that you have her music. Oh, my goodness.
And on a competition that's really amazing, you've probably heard of the Van Cliburn Piano Competition every 4 years.
So I remember seeing him when he first did. Okay, we'll go ahead.
Oh, me too.
Of course.
Me too, in New York before, Van Cliburn himself. But so I think in 1999 or 98, KPBS did a special on, and they did a movie of tape, the Van Cliburn competition. They made a movie of it. And one of the contestants that actually tied for first place that year, which was very unusual, Olga Kern, was playing the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto, which is extremely difficult. It's said one of the most difficult piano concertos. She had a score from her grandmother. And wish I can remember. I always forget this conductor's name who actually produced this film.
Well, maybe he's an amazing conductor.
Right,
now.
He's an amazing conductor, and he conducted, so guest conducted here last year, and so he was. She showed the score because they were rehearsing this, and she had the score. And when I tell you that there were little pieces flaked off from her grandmother's copy of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto, mm-hmm. but she had that, and it was her grandmother's.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't even turn a page, and things would just fall. I mean, paper would just trickle down. It was so old, but so loved by her.
Well, that's what it's about.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, thank you so much for doing this with
You're
me.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed
into
this.
Bringing yourself into my life. I appreciate that so
thank
much.
Thank you, Janet.
I hope we'll talk again.
I'd love to.
Okay. So until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye, and goodbye to you, and thank
goodbye.
You, Maura, for this.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.